Hi, I'm Jack Farley with Real Vision. I'm here with our managing editor, Ed Harrison. Ed, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. So yeah, this is going to air on Thanksgiving Day, November 26th, but we're filming this on Tuesday, 2 days before. So, you know, if the Dow goes back to 24,000, if there's a massive crash, please, the people at home, you know, don't judge us too much if we sound bullish.
Do you have your Dow 30,000 hat out? I was looking for one. I was talking to Ash about this. We finally crossed over the Rubicon.
Yeah, well, we need to get hats. I think I had a joke on Twitter that Max bet me that if the Dow went to 30,000, I would change my Hinge profile to a photo of Jim Cramer, like partying in Miami.
Excellent.
So that's not the only special thing about today's daily briefing is that we're filming it 2 days before. We're also, it's an AMA. We're taking questions from Real Vision members. So I asked in the exchange, what questions you have for Ed and for me. And I think honestly, these are the best questions that we've ever gotten for any AMA on the daily briefing. Ed, I know you haven't even looked at these questions, so I'm going to be asking you the questions. I'm really excited for it.
Yeah. And so, I mean, as we were saying right before we came on, we're going to divvy them up. You're going to put them out there. You can take half of them. I'll take, some of the ones that are obvious for me. And let's just see how it goes.
Okay. Well, starting off, Jonathan Jessen asks, with Europe and U.S. entering a second wave of lockdowns, will equities have a repeat of their March performance? I think this question is for you.
Yeah, that is a good question. I'm a better bond guy. Let me put it this way, just go from the bonds to the equity side of things. I think that, bonds, you can clip the coupons, but when bad things happen from an economic perspective and defaults occur, then, that's when you the separation between those who have done well and those who don't do well is made. I had a good conversation with Boaz Weinstein about this. So to the degree that this particular lockdown causes certain companies to default or even potentially to have their numbers go much worse in terms of spreads, then you're going to see a massive reaction in the bond market. So there's a good potential for that to happen just because the bond market is very different than the equity market. I think the equity market might be able to power through this based on liquidity and a forward-looking approach as long as these companies don't go to zero. So I think that the real answer is if a company goes to zero, then the equity gets wiped out and the bonds default and therefore, there are bad outcomes. But absent that, it's really hard to say what's going to happen over the short to medium term because I don't really think that this particular wave is a long-term outcome. We know on the backside of it, we have the vaccine. So I'm going to have to punt on that, Jack, and say, really, we don't know what's going to happen. A lot of it is liquidity-fueled rally.
That's so interesting, Ed. I have a million questions, but the one that comes to mind is, you said at the very end, I don't know if this wave will last. Were you referring to sort of the second wave or third wave of corona, or this the flood of liquidity that we've had? And, when we're filming today, the Dow and the S&P are at all-time highs.
Yeah, I was thinking about the second wave, because I was just talking to some investors, Charles Gove, and one of his analysts at Gove Call, and they were talking about the vaccine coming out, and by this time next year, perhaps 75% of us are going to be vaccinated. So what we're going through right now as a second wave won't necessarily, or actually in the United States, the third wave won't be repeated per se. When the next year comes around.
That's so interesting. I have another question that just I want to pick your brain, Ed. Which is that let's say that the vaccine is administered to the bulk of the population, people begin to fly again. I mean, they're flying, but people begin to go on cruises again. You know, oil is rebounding as people travel all around the country. Is there a scenario where that actually could sink the S&P because all of this market capitalization that's been gathering in that index, which is, you know, as you know, tech dominated, has been going to the Googles, not just the Googles and the Amazons and the Facebooks, but the you know, the Zooms and the Teslas as well, that are sort of like thriving at this work at home economy.
Yeah, I've thought about that too. The concept that if you have a rotation, that the rotation is so violent that given the market cap weight, you have an overall diminution of the S&P, because the places, the stay-at-home companies, which were the largest market cap companies, they're really getting hammered as a result of that. I think it's a possibility, definitely. So I wouldn't rule it out as a outcome from this particular rotation, if that rotation occurs. And I think that it will occur at some point in time.
Interesting. So Jonathan Jessen actually asked a multi-part question. It's in four parts, and we're not going to indulge, you know, every single one of his questions. But just to his last question, Ed, what is your outlook on commodities in 2021?
Yeah, I don't have a firm view on commodities, but I will say that commodities look good because we're going to have the vaccine, we're going to have a reopening, and I think that we're already seeing that the numbers are starting to go up for oil. Copper actually preceded that, and a lot of other commodities. So I'm positive on commodities in terms of at least maintaining where they are. The real question is, there more upside, or has it already been priced in? So when we talk about bonds versus equities, and then we think about commodities on top of that, I think that when you take a look through, you look through this particular wave, commodities will look through the wave, and on the other side, things will be positive.
Mm-hmm. That sort of leads into the next question, because I think commodities thriving in 2021, that happens if there's a reflation, which is a pickup in inflation. So this next question comes from Nin Nguyen. Jack and Ed, I'd love your take on the risk on and risk off factors that would allow one thesis to hold true versus another. I saw Roger's insiders talk today, and it looks like there's a battle of narratives with the inflation or reflation narrative versus a flight to safety into bonds, which presumably corresponds to a sell-off in equities. So what do you think of that?
Well, I was thinking this is a perfect place for you to step in yourself and defend your turf. I think this is something that's totally in your wheelhouse. What are your thoughts there, Jack?
I think I agree with all of the premises of the question. I think a risk-on event happens if capital floods into the stocks that are banking on a quick recovery. You know, your cruises, airliners, oil refiners, and the like. I think it all comes down to the virus and to the ability of the government to administer a vaccine. I think the efficacy of the vaccine, 90.9%. Oh, it's 95%. Oh, actually, we're 95% too. That's all great. And that, I think that's, you know, I think what Stan Druckenmiller said is like a great day in the history of mankind. And I think that is wonderful news. I think, though, I would rather sort of, I think it's a better scenario to have an 80% efficacy rate and a, you know, a strong healthcare system that has a demonstrated track record of being able to deliver healthcare to, you know, a bulk amount of population rather than just people who walk through the door, than say we have a 95% efficacy, but I don't have a lot of confidence, to be honest, in the United States healthcare system, which is sclerotic. It's the only you know, major developed world where healthcare is not guaranteed by the government, whether that's through just the government authorities like in the UK, or it's sort of a public-private partnership like they have in other parts of Europe. To be honest, this girl who I have started seeing recently, so she got tested for coronavirus over the weekend so she could see her family. And she went to a city MD. And Ed, take a guess as to how long it took her? How long did she have to wait in line?
Let me guess, you know, because my wife was doing the exact same thing, and it took her 2 hours.
Wow. 2 hours is a lot of time. And when I got my test, I waited 2 hours, and I thought that was a lot of time. She had to wait 8 hours.
Wow, huh? Eight hours. That is crazy.
Yeah, so I'm not convinced that the United States will administer this vaccine with the rapidity and the comprehensiveness that we sort of need. And I don't like saying that, and I don't think that is good for risk assets. Incidentally, I talked today to Teddy Valley of Per Valley Global. He's a macro fund who invests in all sorts of assets. And he is a big believer in the reflation trade, and he's investing heavily in energy stocks. And interestingly, you know, he's someone who has been very bullish on gold and Bitcoin, and he's been proven right, but he's actually kind of taking his foot off the gas pedal on gold and Bitcoin. So that airs on Tuesday, because, you know, Ed, they call me the plug. Teddy's actually up something like 30 or 40% this year, which is a lot. But I think one of the only fund managers who's up more is Boaz Weinstein. So, and that airs on Friday.
Right.
Which people at home will be tomorrow.
Excellent. Hey, and you know, okay, two thoughts on that. Thought number one is, one of the biggest problems with the U.S. healthcare system in this regard is what I would call the inability to keep the virus in check. If we had as many tests as we do now, but we had one third the number of cases, maybe your girlfriend would have waited an hour or 30 minutes instead of having to wait 8 hours. It's because the virus has spiraled out of control in the United States. We have so many cases that she had to wait as long. That's my first thought. Maybe you can answer that. But the second thought I had, which is interesting, is when you talk about risk on versus risk off, based upon efficacy and things of that nature, it makes me think about Asia. And when you think about asset allocation, who's going to come out of this on the other side in a positive way? In terms of your allocation of assets, I know Jeremy Grantham was talking about emerging markets. Well, emerging markets, Asia, in particular, maybe that's the answer there.
Yeah, definitely. It's a really interesting question, and then it becomes more complicated because you ask, well, what is risk on? It's equities. Okay, well, is it FANG? Because if there's a risk off event in terms of bad news about the virus, that actually could be good for FANG because of work from home and the technology stock. So it's very complicated, but I want to move on to a question from Oliver Anderson, who asks, this is a good question, Ed, you're gonna like this. Real Vision began as a platform for conversations that were generally quite wonky in finance, sort of inside baseball, especially against the backdrop of the wider and generally terrible financial reporting landscape. My guess is that this is what has set you apart and earned Real Vision such an incredibly loyal following for very bright, engaged individuals. Now, as you're starting to reach a broader audience, as well as one that isn't bringing the same baseline understanding of markets, the need to make content that caters to this new audience's needs, I'm sure, can come into conflict with the interest of your original audience. How are you navigating scaling up Real Vision with keeping the content that makes you so special in the financial media space?
Yeah, that is a great question. And on the fly, what my answer is the question. Also, I'd love to hear your answer to this, because this is how I'm thinking about it. You know, dumbing things down, that's not my idea of a good time. You know, if I'm going to have a conversation with someone, I want to have the same conversation that I would have naturally, irrespective. And I have very great confidence in Real Vision viewers to be able to pause and, you know, ask the right questions, look it up on the internet, et cetera, whatever it might be. The big filler for that, however, is, you know, these explainers, these pieces by the likes of Stephen Van Meter, which Roger's doing something like that on the pro tier, which basically says, okay, if you watch the real video and you only got 50%, 75% of what's being said, we can break it down for you in a way that will get you to 90, 95%. I think those are great. And that's one of the ways forward for us in terms of making this work. But I don't think dumbing it down is one of the ways forward. The second thing I would say, Jack, is that we do need more content for other people. I know a plethora of people who they don't really care about hardcore finance at all, but they do care about the political economy. They do care about public policy. And I think that being able to provide a more expansive view than just hardcore finance in terms of, the perfect example is this Charles Kennedy interview that I did. He talked about venture capital in the healthcare system. I think those kinds of things are important. Haley talked to someone about public charter schools. I think that was also an important conversation. It's not in the wheelhouse of what we used to be, but I think it is something that is important in terms of thinking about the political economy. And so I hope that we can continue to do that. So that's my answer, Jack.
Absolutely. I think a lot of what you said, I agree with. I think explainers are really important because we have these videos like Russell Napier talks to Brent Johnson, and it is very complicated. You know, I'm watching it, and, you know, I don't have a deep background in finance, but I am watching it very closely because I'm sort of making the charts and writing the chapters, writing the copy. And you know, even a few things go over my head. So I can imagine people who are, you know, watching things and they have a job and they're busy with their lives and with their families. They don't have time to delve into it with as much depth as I do because, you know, Real Vision is my job. So I think explainers are really important. I think what Stephen Van Meter does is great. And I think we should definitely expand that. I think that is key. What you said with regards to sort of widening the funnel, which is a phrase that we use a lot at Real Vision, in terms of covering topics in the political economy, as well as social issues and how they intersect with markets, I think that's really important. I think, though, another thing is that we're going to get a lot of people to come on the platform from crypto, which is our latest offering. It's something that Ash is working on with Raoul. Raoul is very keen on it. And I think, you know, with Bitcoin sort of testing, it's approaching the $20,000 level. I think there could be some renewed interest in that. So I think, you know, Ed, what I want to focus on with you is sort of to how, like, people who come to the Real Vision for Bitcoin because they love Bitcoin content, how can we interest them and say, oh, actually, well, you like crypto. Well, here's something. Here's a piece about debt. Here's a piece about equities. Here's why, you know, something that you've wondered your entire life, but you never knew the answer to it. Here's why. So I think that is a project that we'll focus on as well.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah, and you know, the integrative approach is good. I mean, all of these things are not seen in isolation. There's overlap. You can get a whole collective, and definitely crypto is a part of that. So we have to be asking ourselves, what is it that's happening on Real Vision Classic that has overlap with crypto? And every week we should be offering something on both sides that flips between the two. Gold and silver certainly has some applicability. Digital currency, whether it's central bank digital currency or Bitcoin, they're interrelated. monetary policy, totally related to what's happening with crypto. So I definitely see it from that perspective, really getting a huge integrated approach.
Okay. Ed, I sort of raised up crypto at the end because it's what I believe, but I also raised it sort of just as a little segue to this fantastic question from Alan Azar. A thought experiment. You're a supervillain bent on ruining my day. Hypothesize how you would drive down the price of Bitcoin substantially, if not destroy it entirely. Extra points if you answer while stroking a white cat.
I think this is for you, Jack. This is your question, 100%. The supervillain, I like it.
Well, I think that Bitcoin thrives at a period of monetary uncertainty when it looks like the printing presses will go on all night and never end. So I don't know, the Fed having a Paul Volcker moment and raising rates to 16-18%, that could put a damper on Bitcoin. What do you think, Ed?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's liquidity and then there is store value. And I think that over time, cryptocurrencies are becoming a better store of value. However, when it comes to liquidity concerns, everyone wants to get into an asset like the U.S. dollar, where liquidity is greater. And so in times like March, you know, Bitcoin will go down with everyone else. But over time, to the degree that you have more dollars chasing fewer goods, and part of that's because of the base, you know, the monetary base, but much of that's definitely going to have to be because you still have velocity of money where banks are adding to the credit portfolio. I think that's a case in which you could get more, you can get the gold higher, you can get Bitcoin higher. And it all depends on the currency system and how it atomizes. I think that over time, the dollar standard is probably going to break down to a certain degree, and central banks are going to get in there and they're going to stop other media of exchange to competing with the dollar, like gold, which was banned outright during the Great Depression in the United States and remained that way. You couldn't hold gold as a private citizen in the U.S. for years and years. So I think that, you know, the more you see credit as opposed to the more you see actual base money, that's where you're going to see Bitcoin do well in the exact same way that you've seen gold do well.
So what do you have to do in order to, make Alan Azar's worst nightmare come true? Do you have to take away the punch bowl as the Fed Reserve, hike rates, stop QE, don't support regional banks at all?
I would say, I'm thinking about this conversation I had with Charles Gobb earlier today, and he was talking about a similar topic to what Jay Polosky talks about, which is this tripolar world where you have regional deepening in the Americas, in Europe, and in Asia. And in Asia, it's as a result of bilateral currency arrangements, as opposed to using the U.S. dollar to have trade between Taiwan and Korea. They actually use their local currencies as a result of that. And the upshot of all that is that if the dollar is not needed from a liquidity perspective by large swaths of the emerging markets and non-US, then it ceases to be as valuable a currency, and therefore it goes down in value. So when you think about Bitcoin, it could be a very different outcome for Bitcoin versus Asian currencies, or versus the US dollar, or versus the euro. It all depends on, I think, how this currency regime shakes out. So that's my thinking, is that if you really want to be the supervillain, then you want, if you're in Asia, the supervillain is where the Asians abandon the dollar and they start trading with one another in their own currencies, and they allow those currencies to appreciate relative to the dollar over time. That would be poison for Bitcoin as expressed in those currency terms.
That's really interesting. Very advanced thinking. I want to talk about that more, but I have to go on to Si-Yung Park, who's got a question that it just has Ed Harrison written all over it. any tips on learning a new language or / getting better at a language?
Yeah, I had this when I was young. I had some friends of mine, and we were trying to create this new method of learning. I think my method of learning is basically, recreate the environment of being in the country as much as you possibly can. And in today's world, it's so much easier than it was before. Back then, it would be about trying to meet people from that country and having as many conversations with them as possible, listening to the news over shortwave radio in those countries, and then listening to movies in those languages. But today you could live and breathe as if you're in another country. Let's say that you wanted to learn Chinese. You could really get the Chinese news. You could get Chinese podcasts. You could talk to people over the internet in Chinese. So it's really all about using the fact that you can almost live inside the country without actually having to go to the country. And for me, that's when you start thinking in the language. That's how a language gets embedded into your mind.
Okay. I think that was a complete answer to Si-Hung's second question, like the second half, which was how do you get better? Say like, oh, I've been, taking Korean for like a year now. I want to take it to the next level. And you live in the next level, Ed. But like for someone like me who I don't know any French, how do I get started?
Yeah. That's a good question. I would say for me, the easiest hurdle to do is to do something that you've already done in your own language or a language that you know, and do it in that foreign language. I have read a book in French that I had already read in German before. And because I'd already read it in German, I didn't need to go to the dictionary over and over again. I actually almost, all I had to have was a basic vocabulary, and immediately, just through circumstance, and it's the exact same way when people are talking to you, I could tell from context what what they were saying without having to understand it. And that's how you learn in the real world, is you kind of learn half the words through context. People are talking to you that way. So that's what I would say to do. Watch a movie that you've already seen in English, but watch it in the foreign language.
Nice. Okay. Just for the viewers at home, Ed speaks English, German, Spanish, French, and Swedish. Am I missing any?
Yeah, I think that is in Dutch.
Dutch, of course. Great. Okay, moving on to the next question. This is from James Rosenthal, who is a certified super user on the exchange. He makes excellent videos, very well produced, and he actually is himself a futures trader. So he's kind of like he's a triple threat. That's his nickname, James Triple Threat Rosenthal. Okay, so this is from James. What type of guys are Jack Farley and Edward Harrison around the Real Vision Circle? Like, clearly, Ed might be the, quote, three-quarter zip guy. Jack could be the, quote, the young gun with huge potential. Ash is clearly the crypto guy. Roger is, quote, the lush wino, .. Would love to know a bit more about what you guys are like outside of all this economic talk. Cheers and keep crushing life. Thank you, James.
Let me answer for you. This is what I would say, Jack. I'd say two things. One, we already know about your nickname, your new nickname, Hollywood, that you not only are you the young gun, you're bringing it in a way that is like, a certain like pizzazz, a certain flash, if you will. Hollywood definitely embodies that. The second thing I think that people don't know is, and I think we were talking about this with regard to Tyler, is that once you get to a certain level, height-wise, it's like an exponential increase in the number of people who ask, are you a basketball player? You are well above that level. I'm sure that, more people ask you if you play basketball than ask me, especially at my advanced age, if I play basketball. People don't know because, you know, they only see you from here, but you are the giant of Real Vision, if you will.
Yeah, I am like 6'4" and a half. So I generally, you know, round up to 6'5", but sometimes if I want to sort of, you know, don't make too big of a splash, I round down to 6'4". I think the only person who's taller than I am at Real Vision is Raoul Powell, who's very tall.
Oh, yeah. Is he taller than you? That is interesting. Yeah. I did not know that. Hey, now, listen, here's a good story for you on that, Jack. And you can tell me who I am after I tell you the story. So I these friends from the Netherlands, where everyone's really tall. I think the average height is like 6 foot there. And these guys, they were all like 6'6". But apparently there's a clause somehow where you can avoid, forced national service. This was years ago when they had forced national service. If you're above a certain height, I think the height was 2 meters tall. So these guys, they would like for literally a month or however long it was before they got measured and weighed to go into the service, they would lie down as much as possible. They would try not to be vertical so that they could lengthen their body out as much as possible. And if they went and immediately got measured, they could potentially squeeze out that extra half an inch.
Wow, that's incredible. Can I ask, why is it that if you're above a certain height, you're exempt from the military service?
Yeah, I think that's for our audience to explain, because I have no idea. All I know is the stories that they told me about it, but maybe one of our Dutch listeners can tell us why the hell was that the case. And also, I think that they don't have the compulsory military service anymore. I think that's been banned, but that's how it was, 20 years ago.
Interesting. So... James, maybe we'll have to, Ed and I will have to come into the exchange and, to really let our guard down. Because, we're still on the professional channel, so we can't give up too many of our secrets. I will say that Ed is, he's like one of those guys where you meet him and he's like very intellectually curious and like just devours news, like analysis, books, everything. So he's like, what a nerd typically is in terms of like being very intellectually motivated, but he also is a very cool guy. And if you, I don't know if he ends any of the daily briefings like this, but frequently on our calls, editorial calls at 5 p.m., he's like, "All right, guys, I'm going to end this call a little bit early. I'm going to go have a beer." So, Ed is like, he's a very cool guy, and he has that nice balance of, very intellectually active while also being chill.
Excellent. Thank you, Jack. I appreciate that.
Anytime. All right, let's move on to Sam Colt, who is also a super user in the exchange. How do you guys filter news? And I think both of us can answer this question, but you definitely are sort of the expert, and then I'll show how the sort of struggling along.
Yeah, I think for me, what I'm looking for is preponderance of narrative and difference of narrative, if you will. So usually I use my international filter. So I try to read a broad sweep of different stuff. I read the South China Morning Post. I read one or two dailies from all of the European languages I speak. And then I look at the news in the U.S. and I try not to watch TV. I usually get all my news from written. And I'm looking to see what kind of narratives they're saying and get a composite picture of what's being said. And there are little nuances in the way that people say things based upon what country it's in. And as a result of that, you get a much better composite picture. You get a sense of, where there is consistency and then where there are differences. And so that's how I look at my news. I think that's the most important factor.
Interesting. Could you say in English speaking papers, what are some of your favorites, some of your go-tos?
Yeah, so I think Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, Barron's. I do read the Post and the New York Times. Did I say again? So I think in terms of non-business, I probably only read the Post and the New York Times mostly. In the UK, I read the Times of London, I read the Guardian, and I read the Telegraph. So
wow.
That gives me, and, you know, by the way, those are very different in terms of their view. And so I think it gives me a good wide swath across the political spectrum. And that's what I'm trying to get, so that I'm not trapped in one universe of thought.
Not trapped in one universe of thought. That's beautiful, Ed. You really are very well read. And I think there aren't a lot of people who are truly well read and who always, you know, like I definitely am trapped in one universe of thought or two universes of thought. You know, one of the great things of working at Real Vision, I've got my Bloomberg terminal here. So I kind of just, most of the news I take is through that. I also, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, FT, they're great. But what I love about just reading it on the terminal is I can click on it and it's a news story that like you can get on BloombergNews.com. But then it says like, click this for the analysis and it will take you to some, you know, some futures chart or something like that. So, you know, a lot of what I do at Real Vision is sort of making the charts. So if like Mike Green says, oh, this like Bermuda swaption is indicating this, like I'm the one who has to find out what the hell that means.
I think that's an amazing thing, because it goes back to what you were saying about you're like, I'm no finance expert, but actually relative to most people you are, because your wheelhouse is about taking news, which is actually predominantly financial in nature, because you're talking about Bloomberg and then connecting it to markets and how they function. So automatically, it's almost as if your knee-jerk reaction is that, okay, so how do I trade that, right? I mean, soon as you get the news piece, immediately, because of just the way that you consume it, that's what's going on.
Yes, and this makes me think of the classic thing that you, I, and Ash talk about, which is the as-amid phenomenon, which is X event happens, Pelosi doesn't sign this. It's announced this earnings do this, and then there's some trading action, and then the journalist does, you know, they don't know what's going on, not because they're not smart, but because no one knows what's going on.
Right.
And then they have to confabulate these two narratives and intertwine them. So they use the word as. So, markets crash as Treasury Secretary Mnuchin indicates that he won't roll over these federal emergency programs, despite the fact that you don't really know. I mean, you know if it was announced at 248 and then you see a big spike or a big crash, but it's an infinite number of coins that are flipping throughout the ether.
And, you know, let's talk about that in terms of yesterday, what happened there, because I was reading something, I can't remember what it was now, but it said that immediately after Yellen was announced as the Treasury Secretary, markets spiked up, but then they ended the day less high than they were when they spiked up because of the announcement. So what are we supposed to take away from that in terms of, is the Yellen announcement moving markets? I mean, it moved them temporarily, but does that have any durable impact?
That's a good point. I think the people who believe that this stuff actually matters, and when I say matters, obviously it matters in the long term because the real world does shape the financial economy, but they think that it does have an impact in terms of the price action. They would say maybe, well, it would have gone down less. But then at that point, you know, what are you even saying?
Yeah. So, I mean, I just tend to I look at people like Tony Greer, and I think that he has a much better handle on thinking about trading the markets than I do. I'm much more of a fundamental guy.
Me too.
And, it's difficult for me to operate in that universe. So all hats off to him. And that's one of the reasons that I enjoy having him on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Yeah, definitely. So you talked about Tony Greer, he has a better framework for trading than you do. Actually, one of Sam Colt's last question is about sort of how we trade, but they're not that personal. So the questions are, first stock that you bought, and then the second question is, what's the worst trade you ever made?
Yeah. I think the worst trade I ever made was a unhedged derivatives out of the money call in size that was, I mean, the you know, it's like trade sizing. this was like completely disproportionate to the size of my portfolio. This was during the aftermath of the internet bubble, in fact. You know, having already benefited from the internet bubble bursting, you know, my hubris allowed me to go in that direction. So that's the worst call I ever made. This in terms of the first trade I ever did, it's hard to say. It's been so long now. I don't know what it was. It could have easily, just as easily have been short as it was long, to be honest, because at that point, I think I was very skeptical. And so I might have gone in on the short side, but I just don't remember.
Wow, that's rare for someone to have their first short be a first trade be a short. I think I too sort of have that bug in you, and that I kind of like going short something. For me, it would be via put option. But Jim Chanos talks about how, like, if you're a short seller, you're born a short seller. And I don't think you and I are sort of pure short sellers, but we have that skeptics gene, you know?
Yeah, and I was talking to someone. I think it was Boaz Weinstein, who was telling me, he was talking about he's not able to see the fraud in front of him the way that Jim Chanos is able to see it. You know, some people, they're able to see that. You know, when I look at, you know, I was short a lot of the home builders, and I was short like Washington Mutual back during the housing bubble days. But, you know, none of those, I wasn't thinking fraud. Jim Chanos, on the other hand, he's seen accounting irregularities. He's seen companies like Enron and WorldCom. He's saying, wait a minute, hold on. There's something seriously wrong with this company. It's fraudulent, and I'm willing to put my money behind it. That's a really tough racket, something that I take my hat off to him on, because not everyone can do that.
Yeah, and it's also, it becomes a matter of semantics with, okay, they accounted for this in a certain way, and that was arguably unethical. You know, did not conform to precedent. It pissed off the regulators, but it really isn't a proven fraud until the CEO is, you know, taken out in handcuffs. I mean, not right.
Yeah, well, you know, let me ask you this. I don't know if you know the history, but back in the day under Jack Welch in GE, they used to beat their earnings estimates by a penny every quarter, it seemed like. It was just like, you know, and of course, obviously, the given math, you know that the potential that this is really going to happen isn't actually, it's mathematically impossible that they could beat by a penny every single quarter relative to chance. So it was clearly that they were massaging the numbers. And then lo and behold, you know, years later, GE falls apart. How much of that was a representation of the culture that was being built that was suggested by the beat by a penny, a quarter type of mentality? Is it that Jack Welch was building a fraudulent empire in the sense of it was built on smoke and mirrors? Or was it that somehow it just the world changed and GE wasn't able to catch up with it? And then my biggest question on that is, how different is that to what Jim Chanos is talking about? Because to me, it's the first part that is easier to see than the second part. You know, like Tesla, you can make a case that they're overvalued based upon X, Y, and Z. But to say that, you know, there's an outright fraud that's going on is a lot more difficult to be able to discern.
Definitely. God, I have so much to say to that, Ed. It's so thought-provoking. Number one is with regards to GE. I think I remember, I forget if this was in a book or an article, but it was basically, it was one of the accounting shenanigans. It was a sale leaseback where they basically would sell, I forget the name of it, but it's like the thing that you walk on when you try and get onto a plane. Like, you know, it's an aviation
right.
industrial
the
thing.
Exactly,
jetway. Yeah, they would sell those to businesses, and then lease them back from the businesses. So in the short term, they get cash from that. But really, they have a hidden liability, and that's what Jim Chanos says. It's like talking about IBM, how they cut way down on research and development in order to juice their earnings, which, hey, you know, they're business, they've got shareholders, they've got to make money, you know? But then they have all these acquisitions. So what he's really saying is, you know, their acquisition is basically their R&D. So they're sort of, you know, having them be one-time charges when they're not. Another example that comes to mind is AIG with Hank Greenberg. You know, obviously AIG imploded and it didn't go bankrupt, but it, you know, it's not the company. Yeah, it's not the company it once was. And so it imploded in 2008. But even before that, in 2000, it had to radically restate earnings because it was doing the same thing that Jack Welch was, where it was its earnings would grow at 15% every year. And honestly, I think, like, I mean, you would know this because you actually were in the markets at this time. But this is from what I've read. It kind of seems like that was a little bit less of a scandal to massage your numbers before Enron. And then when Enron happened, there was Sarbanes-Oxley's and there was this huge oversight of auditors that, you know, actually suddenly took their jobs very seriously.
Right. Yeah, I it definitely was the case. I mean, as I recall, it was just like clockwork. They could do this, you know, throw the kitchen sink at the number in a way that, you know, from an accounting perspective, to beat that number. That was all it was all about, is just doing whatever you needed to do to get, you know, one penny more. Ultimately, the kinds of things that you did, it accumulates over time. If you're doing that on a consistent basis, and the delta is always to the upside, trying to get to a number as opposed to massage down, that's going to catch up to you 5 years down the line, 10 years. But it takes a long time for it to catch up. And it sounds like Jim Chanos is saying the same thing's happening with IBM right now, and he thinks that it's catching up with them in the near future.
Absolutely. And Jim Chanos says that he rarely shorts something because it's overvalued. Because if something's overvalued, it could get a lot more overvalued.
Right.
He shorts something because he thinks there's either a fraud going on, or he thinks that there's going to be a catalyst that's going to trigger like an earnings restatement, and then that will sort of unwind the day's chain.
Yeah, all very interesting stuff. Yeah. For me, that if you think about markets in terms of macro and micro, that's where the rubber hits the road in terms of micro. That's where it's really interesting. And it's completely different than the world of macro, which is global economy, commodities, things of that nature.
Definitely. Well, Ed, thanks so much. I really enjoyed this. You know, I love any time I get to host the Daily Briefing, but I think this AMA was especially fun for me.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. And let's do it again sometime soon.
Absolutely. And I'd also like to thank all of our users who asked the questions through the Real Vision Exchange. If you think that, you know, this episode was good, I think part of the reason it was good was because you guys asked such excellent questions.